Well, you are listening to The Space Show.
The Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
Now, welcome to our 81st Space Show special, in which we cover the public hearings of President Bush's Moon, Mars and Beyond Commission. We are in New York to hear the nine commissioners' initial impressions of the evidence they have heard as they toured the United States, gathering the evidence they will use to prepare their report to the President. Their charge has been to show how to put into effect the President's vision for returning humans to the Moon and later to establish bases on Mars. The commission was chaired by Pete Aldrich, who spent 42 years in positions of aerospace technology leadership. Commissioner Carlton Fiorina was, at the time of the Moon-Mars hearings, chairman and chief executive of officer of Hewlett-Packard, I should say chairwoman. Before joining the Hewlett-Packard in 1999, she had served in senior executive positions at AT&T and Lucent Technologies. To launch today's proceedings, Pete Aldrich will introduce Carly, who will sum up the evidence presented to the Commission on the rationale for sustainability in space.
First on the agenda, it so happens it is alphabetical order first, and that is Carly Fiorina, sustainability rationale. Carly, we'd like to hear what you have to say.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think it's been clear through all of our deliberations that we are concerned about the sustainability of this mission because it requires a long-term commitment, and a long-term commitment by its nature requires broad-based support and bipartisan support and public support. And I think the requirement for that broad-based support means we have to start by asking a very fundamental question: why are we bothering at all? I mean, why are we thinking about going to Moon, Mars, and beyond when there are so many problems right here on Earth and so much budget pressure right here on Earth? And I think we have heard a number of compelling rationales. I think we have heard in very eloquent terms about what I will broadly call the greatness and glory of this mission. We've heard people talk about a great nation such as the United States should embark on great missions, and this is certainly one of them. We've heard from our own president saying that this mission lifts our national spirit. It is glorious in its quest. And I think we've heard as well from many folks, some of our public comments from citizens, for example, have said this represents an opportunity for the United States to lead the world in a positive way. I think we've heard as well about the scientific value of such a mission. And indeed, as Administrator O'Keefe commented on many times, the exploration is a primary purpose of this mission. And the scientific value goes to our ability to ask some of the most fundamental questions of all, like, where did life come from? And I certainly would not in any way underestimate the scientific value of the mission. I think we've also heard a category of answers to the question why that I would broadly describe as the inspiration of it all. We've heard people say the human being is an explorer by nature. Our president said it is a desire written in the human heart. I believe in San Francisco we heard Ray Bradbury say, you know, when the Congress gets bogged down in budget deliberations, ask our children and they will point ecstatically to the sky and say, yes, we must go. So this is a great mission. It's a glorious mission. It's an inspiring mission, and it is a mission of great worth in terms of scientific discovery. But the pragmatist in all of us says none of those rationales is sufficient. And indeed, I do not believe they are sufficient, although I believe them strongly, individually. I don't believe they are sufficient to compel a broad-based, long-term, bipartisan level of support. And so I think we have to look to, as well, very pragmatic here-on-earth reasons. And I'll start perhaps with the most fundamental, which is if we don't do it, someone will. And while I recognize when I say that that this is not the era of Sputnik, it's pretty clear from the testimony we've heard that China has a very active space program, Russia has a very active space program, India has a very active space program, the Europeans are interested as well, the Japanese are interested. While it may take longer, someone will eventually figure out how to send men and women into space and exploit that discovery and ultimately perhaps commercialize it. And so I think the United States should lead. If we don't, others will. And it's important for us to be the first to protect, candidly, our military, economic, and political leadership in the world. I think secondly, even more near in perhaps than that, is that the 21st century is a century about technology. Leadership in the 21st century depends upon technology leadership. And today, our leadership in technology and the industrial base that flows from that is threatened by other nations who are very much focused on gaining technology leadership. We have had a great deal of debate in the press about the exodus of high-tech manufacturing jobs, about the tragedies of outsourcing. And what's interesting to me is very few people yet have connected up that if we want to stay leaders in high-tech manufacturing, we have to lead in those industries that create high-tech manufacturing jobs. Space is one of those industries. The United States has to lead in those industries that create technology leadership. And those industries include certainly computing technology, biotechnology, but they as well include space and aeronautics. We have heard, I think, quite eloquently from a number of unionized workers who say every dollar spent in space is a dollar spent here on Earth. We represent high-tech manufacturing jobs, and if we do not choose to take this mission, our technology base will erode. I was also interested to see one of our other panelists describe this, but this article in the New York Times, Losing Our Dominance in Science. Unfortunately, this article didn't yet connect up with keeping a dominance in science means going after industries that rely upon science and technology, and clearly space is one of those. So I think that's the second pragmatic reason here on Earth. Our technology leadership is key to our economic leadership in the 21st century, and economic leadership is key to ongoing prosperity for all Americans. I think the third reason is, again, referenced in this article, the cold, cruel reality is that the children in the United States, their ability to compete and prosper in the 21st century is, on a relative basis, in decline. When we look at our preparedness in math and science and engineering in the 21st century, on a relative basis, we are becoming less, not more, competitive. And in order to reverse that trend, we must not only engineer our educational system, and I think we've heard from a lot of people that an inspiring mission like space can help do that, but we also have to lead in those industries that create the demand pull for the skilled labor. So I guess what I'm trying to say, perhaps in a too lengthy way, is that while the destination is grand and glorious and inspiring and worthy scientifically, the journey that we are going to have to take here on Earth in a very pragmatic way is, in the near term, what this is all about and worthy of public support. And I think we have to really help people make that connection. Mm-hmm. I guess two other comments I would make before I stop here. First, I think we have heard from so many people that sustainability is going to require grassroots support. and it will require NASA, the administration, all of us to tap into grassroots support. As you commented earlier, we heard so almost plaintively yesterday from one of our witnesses, we all wanted to go. And so I think we have to provide recommendations on how to keep this a very broad-based mission with a broad base of support. And I think that means a couple things. I think it means some people are offended by the term marketing. I don't happen to be one of them. I think marketing, when done well, is speaking to people in language they understand. But I think we are talking about straightforward communication that educates people about the inspiration of all this, the real risks of all of this, but as well the very pragmatic and necessary rewards of it. I think we are talking about some innovative ways of galvanizing grassroots support. We heard one actually today from the student who said, help recruit us. We heard as well a great idea about a simulation game that would engage people in a very real life kind of way in what space exploration could be about. We heard as well about an idea of allowing children to operate robots on the moon through the web. All of those are great ways of galvanizing grassroots support. I think it will be important to keep the support going that we as well have a set of metrics and milestones so that we are achieving measurable success along the way. This is a long journey, and people will want to know, where are we now, and are we achieving the things that we intended to? And finally, as I think has been noted many times, it's very clear that the private sector will have to be engaged in this journey even more deeply than they have been engaged in missions before. And that not only means the big traditional contractors, it means entrepreneurs, it means private capital, venture capital, and I think that will be critically important as well.
Moon, Mars and Beyond Commissioner Carly Fiorina with her summary of the evidence presented to the Commission on the rationale for a sustainable space program. On this evening's space show, we are at the summative session of the Moon, Mars and Beyond Commission. Commissioner Lester Lyles was in the United States Air Force for more than 35 years. He rose through the ranks to become a four-star general in command of the Air Force Material Command. Lyles chose to focus his summary on the Commission's hearings on issues surrounding the sustainability and affordability of the plan to send humans to the Moon and Mars.
Mr. Chairman, I think, as Carly just articulated, talking about the sustainability and affordability and particularly sustaining this vision, it brings the notion that hit each one of us the very first day that we started our deliberations. I recall as we were all sort of introducing ourselves and talking about this particular objective of this commission, in one way or another, each one of us used a term that this is really a national vision. This exploratory vision is not just a space vision. It's not just a vision for NASA. It really is a national vision. That notion has been reinforced throughout our entire process over these last 3.5 months or so. It's been reinforced to each one of us in various ways, and it's sort of shaped in some respects the kinds of thought processes and recommendations that I think ultimately this commission is going to make. I was glad to see Sean put up a chart in talking about the vision for space exploration coming out of the president's speech in January. And the statement he used was that the fundamental goal of this vision is to advance U.S. scientific, security, and economic interests through a robust space exploration program. The vehicle, the journey, is to a robust space exploration. But the objectives are far broader than just space and space exploration itself. And that in itself brings into play lots of other agencies in our federal government, lots of other organizations, lots of other private interests, from the Department of Defense, Department of Energy, Department of Education, universities, lots of private interests and entrepreneurial ideas that are out there. Everybody, and to some extent, is involved in this vision, hence our term that it really is a national vision. And when you think about that and you think of all the stakeholders, all the other vested interests, the common missions that are out there that are very much germane to accomplishing this space exploration vision, it makes you look at everything a little bit differently. One, in how we convey the message, how we maintain that sustainability that Carly so articulately defined, how we manage and organize this whole entity and all the things that are involved in it, and how we leverage the resources that are going to be necessary to accomplish this particular goal. Just looking at the management aspect, when I think about different government organizations alone, federal organizations that could be involved in this, it brings back the notion that perhaps we need to re-stimulate or revitalize the National Space Council, which was at one point chaired by the Vice President, to ensure that different government agencies, different federal entities, different organizations that are all involved in a particular mission, in this case space, are coordinating their activities, are working together, have common visions, common goals, and are articulate in trying to achieve these things as one team. We think perhaps that might be one of the recommendations that we make, that we need such a structure. Even within NASA, as we heard from Sean O'Keefe, he's looking at a different management structure internally to the organization. And we also are making some recommendations, I think, along those lines to keep a broader perspective than just what you normally would think for NASA. So it brings a different approach in how you look at things, how you organize the management aspects of things. We've talked and we've seen today ideas from the Department of Defense about a lead systems integrator. We've heard different other management techniques, things like Joint Strike Fighter, missile defense agencies, as examples of a way that you can take on a broad systems of systems approach for a very, very complicated mission, which certainly this particular exploratory vision encompasses. So it makes you think about things very, very differently. And lastly, I think it gives us a different aspect in how we leverage the resources. And when I say resources, I'm not necessarily talking about just the dollars and cents that are involved. The intellectual capital, the innovative ideas that are out there, the various management techniques, as I mentioned. There are lots of different things and lots of different people, lots of different organizations that can contribute their resources to helping to accomplish this space exploration vision. And I think this notion of a national vision forces us to think of these things much differently than we've done before. One final example of that, enabling technologies. Everywhere we've gone so far, as we've talked to people who have talked to the panel, we've made visits to organizations, we've talked about the notion of some enabling technologies that are key to making sure we accomplish the broad mission here involved in the space exploration. I've been very, very pleased as we've gone around and talked to centers and center directors at Kennedy Space Center, Marshall Space Flight Center, Johnson Space Flight Center, JPL, and we've asked each one of them about their ideas of enabling technologies to accomplish the vision. We also asked some organizations that aren't part of NASA the same questions, and one particular one was the Air Force Research Laboratories that we talked to at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base during our second public hearing. They sent in a list of enabling technologies, their space taxonomy, if you will, and lo and behold, it's very much in sync with what NASA has identified as enabling technologies. Some different mission objectives, but the basic physics, the basic engineering, the basic technologies are very much the same. And again, this broader aspect of a national vision gives us an opportunity to look at things differently, to manage things differently, to bring a lot broader resources to accomplish this goal of space exploration.
Moon, Mars, and Beyond Commissioner Lester Lyles summing up evidence put to the Commission. Michael Jackson came to the Commission as Senior Vice President of AECOM Technology Corporation. Before that, he had been Chief Operating Officer of Lockheed Martin Corporation's Intelligent Transportation Systems Unit. He chose to base his summary of the Moon-Mars hearings on the relationship between the American Space Agency, NASA, and the private sector.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to try to just build off of what we heard from Carly and Les a little bit and zero in on one particular area, which is it was our relationship with the private sector and making this vision successful. But I think it's a good departure point for Carly, what you've talked about with the criteria of sustainability being foremost in our head as we go along. and Les's point that this really is a national objective. So it's not just about NASA and its program. It's about something bigger than that. When I try to unpack a little bit of the testimony that we've heard around the question about how do we do this, there are two big clusters of issues that I think that our folks who have testified before us have been grappling with. One is, what is the right structure for the government to meet this objective for the long haul? How do we organize ourselves to do the job? Who is it that gets organized and how do they get organized? I'm not going to talk about that part. The second part is, how is the private sector to be organized for success? Who is it? What do they do? How do they relate to the government sector? That's what I'd like to talk about. Within the question of the private sector, there are a whole series of constituencies that we have to work with right. If we do it wrong with them, almost in any case, we're going to mess it up. So we have to have success with the educational community, with the scientific community, with the public at large. But a crucial part of this, as you drill down through this, how do you work with the private sector, is the business community that is going to engage and actually help drive the technology and drive the exploration with NASA, with the government, with the nation as we do this. So my focus is on that business community, and I just want to say at the start that I think the question of who is our workforce is something important to just begin with, and it's an obvious point, but one worth stating, that really the workforce at NASA that has brought us this spectacular series of successes in space, and the workforce in the private sector that works so closely together with them, is a national treasure. It's a global treasure, the community of men and women that work on these exploration programs, on these scientific programs. And so our job in thinking about this proper structuring of the private sector's role here has to do with both enabling and supporting and protecting and developing and educating and encouraging and rewarding both our public and private sector colleagues in the right ways. So what we've heard is I think from Administrator O'Keefe, a cornerstone of our conversations among ourselves as well, is that we need to forge for success a new and robust and different relationship between NASA in particular and the private sector. We need to have, to use the expression which I think darn near everybody has now spit out today, to find a way to nurture a robust space industry, not just a space program. It doesn't mean that NASA doesn't have a programmatic set of objectives that they too are going to accomplish. As we heard yesterday, and perhaps it's fair to say that this is a national vision, but it is also a global undertaking. We have to leverage particularly I would like to focus on the private sector's role globally. So this is about taking private sector assets, tools, and innovation from the private sector around the globe as well as domestically. Although I think Carly's point about why we as a nation have to do this is just absolutely vital. It is about preserving the industrial base, the innovation technology that's core not only to the success of the space vision, but to the success of our nation. So I want to just throw out four terms, and then I'll unpack each of them briefly, and then I'll stop. The four terms are innovation, nimble, entrepreneurial, and spiral development, that lesson in Defense Department speak, which we've all taken at the hands, less of you and the chairman. So those four words, innovation, we have to find a way to institutionalize and make normal and make routine the extraordinary ability to change constantly and to think our way through problems which we can't even begin to understand at this date. It's obvious, but exploration will open up these many new technologies. Entrepreneurial work in this sphere is indispensable. NASA is probably more of an exception than any other place in government that I can think about, but by and large, the government doesn't do nimble, innovative work easily. It doesn't come naturally. It takes a lot of hard work. So we need to try to help partner up in the right way with folks in the private sector who can infuse those genes into the public sector colleagues that they'll be working with. Nimble relates to this. Obvious. We have to be quick. We have to learn through a series of progressive steps how to change and take lessons away from that. The word entrepreneurial, we heard from the administrator today. We heard this from just a whole host of people at almost all of our hearings. NASA's charter speaks to the commercialization of space. I believe Bob Walker was responsible in no small measure for making sure that that is part of their charter when he was in Congress. But it speaks to the importance of trying to understand how to find commercial rewards and incentives and utility out of space. That's just an indispensable part about making this partnership work in the right way. It's a sea change in the way NASA deals with the private sector. We're asking for to help think of their role as creating an industry and nurturing an industry and sustaining an industry, but it's a part of what must happen for this to work. This is about large corporations and small corporations. It's about two gals in a garage that have a breakthrough idea that's going to revolutionize some component part of our problem set, but it's also about big organizations who can take the type of skill sets and apply them to these massive problems that will be associated, or massive issues that will be associated with the enterprise. NASA should do the things that are indispensably governmental, and there is in the technology clusters that you talk about, a big list of those that are indispensable for NASA to undertake, and we'll help unpack some of those. But we should try to rely on the commercial sector to do what it can do and NASA doesn't have to do. And I would give an example of that is I'm persuaded that it won't be long that NASA can rely in a much more dependable way on the private sector to get launches into low Earth orbit from the private sector without having to do nearly as much as they have done in the past. Spiral development. It means we have to bite a little bit, chew it, digest it, and think about it before we do the next set of steps. We have to learn lessons in a sequential and routine way and then modify the mission targets or specific tasks to take advantage of what we've learned. Fortunately, and in conclusion, I would say, with only a slight pun intended, this is not rocket science. We have a lot of good management tools and experience on the table that we now must take advantage of, can take advantage of, to make this work. It's not just walking in the dark without any lights. We have procurement tools that are proven in the integrator technology that the Defense Department has used in Joint Strike Fighter, Deepwater at the Coast Guard, and others. We have series of lessons learned about how to leverage engineering tools, modeling tools, procurement methodologies that will make these relationships between the private sector and the government work smoothly. And finally, we have, on the commission, found some degree of attractiveness to the idea of prizes, and not necessarily just small prizes, but trying to create, in effect, a package of incentives and continuously updating that package of incentives to make that relationship work. So, Mr. Chairman, that would conclude my reflections on one constituent part of what we need to do for the vision, which is to engage in a new and aggressive and fruitful way the skill sets of our private sector industries in the U.S. and around the globe.
Mike, I am delighted we have a note taker here, because I think you might have written a chapter in our report.
Moon, Mars, and Beyond Commissioner Mike Jackson with his take on the evidence he heard on the need for a new relationship between the United States government space agency NASA and the country's private sector. Some of these ideas have actually been adopted by President Obama. On this evening's special show, we have heard three of the nine commissioners appointed by President Bush summarize the evidence on which they based their formal report to the President. On our next Moon Mars special feature here on the Space Show, we will hear another three summaries. This has been number 81 in a series of 83 programs written by Andrew Rennie. It has used recordings made available by the Commission and digitally transferred to Southern FM by the Space Show's very own Alan Walker.